Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we are broadcasting from. And also, too, I'd also like to pay my respects to our elders, and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody from around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service NIRS, or if you're tuning in via our app, 98.9FM for the Best Country, which you can download for free from your app store, so please do so. Also, don't forget, this program is podcasted, so you can catch it on our website at 98.9fm.com.au. And don't forget, you can stream us via Spotify and Apple Podcasts, those platforms beaming us into your communities. And as always, it is great to have your company. From the 5th to the 11th of September is National Child Protection Week. And the theme in 2021 is Every Child in Every Community Needs a Fair Go. To treat all of Australia's children fairly, we need to make sure every family and community has what kids need to thrive and to be healthy. My guest on the program is the CEO of SNAKE, which is a national organization which started, I believe, in the 80s as an organization to advocate for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children as well. I'm just looking at a bit on their website about some of their history. And on their website it says, in 1979, the first Aboriginal Child Survival Seminar was held, and that was a national committee of Aboriginal childcare groups to be established as a form for consultation. And as we know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children make up a high percentage of children in out-of-home care as well. And as I mentioned, I'm speaking with the CEO of SNAKE this morning, and I'll bring her in. Good morning. How are you going?
Good morning, Bo. How you doing? If you wouldn't mind, I would also like to acknowledge country, because I'm an Arunta, so I'm from Central Australia, but I'm currently sitting on Boonwurrung country, part of the Kulin Nation, and CEO of SNAKE, National Voice of Our Children, the peak body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and families.
Thanks for that. And before we go any further, you just said where you're from, but I'll ask a bit about yourself. Kathleen Little is joining me, CEO of SNAKE. Just tell us a bit about the work that you do now that you're based in Melbourne, because before that you were involved in media. But yeah, tell us a bit about yourself and what you're doing down in Victoria.
Absolutely. So I am a journalist by trade, although I tend to call myself a storyteller, because I always grew up telling stories and always understood that in order to change messages, you had to change the story that was being told. And I did come to SNAKE after a stint with First Nations Media Australia, which was fantastic, absolutely awesome to be able to representing our incredible Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander media services. But the move to Melbourne was obviously led by, a new job, and that was the ability to work for children and families, which is an incredible great gift, and a really important one at this point in time, because SNAKE, prior to my arrival, had been instrumental in negotiating two new targets through the Closing the Gap framework specific to children. And what's important about that is kids often get left off the radar. They often become absorbed, their rights are absorbed into other projects, and they become part of something else. Whereas what SNAKE says is, hang on, if you really want to be able to make a difference and ensure that every one of our kids has the opportunity to grow up safe and well and thriving, then they have to be a priority. So one of those, of course, was to reduce the number of children in out-of-home care by 45% within 10 years. And the other one was to increase the number of children hitting all their developmental domains before preschool. So really exciting targets to work on, and some really, really exciting work ahead of us as we negotiate the new National Child Protection Plan and the new National Framework for Early Education and Care.
Sounds very interesting and very, very busy as well. A couple of things that you said that I would love to sort of touch on and begin with as well. You mentioned sort of early developmental programs for young kids in preschool and before they sort of hit schooling as well. Why is that important? And is that due to sort of some of the issues that, you know, I guess young kids may face who may be sort of dealing with sort of some learning difficulties?
Oh, absolutely. The first few learning years are absolutely critical to child development. There is no other point in your developmental journey that is as critical as this. But it's also a time when you can, it's also a time of primary intervention, right? So that, and that is getting to the problem before there's even a problem to deal with. So it's a space where you can work with families to, amplify their strengths and identify any gaps that they might need help addressing and any gaps that children might need help in addressing. And for our kids, what's really interesting is most of the frameworks that are designed to measure their success, they weren't designed by us. So they missed incredible strengths that our cultures and communities bring with them. So there's a lot of work to be done in looking at what we already have and using the early learning systems to amplify that and celebrate that. But in order to be able to do that, obviously, it needs investment. Our early year services, there's more than 200 across Australia, actually. And they are incredibly sought after because they're all based in grandmother's law. They all understand intrinsically that it's more than just having a place to go and learn. It's a place where families feel secure because, you know, these organisations, they're developed by our mob, they're developed by our communities. And they link you into the services that you might need, which is very, very different to what we've seen in government approaches, which is usually to link up a system where system shares information about you and then says it supports you. Our experience, as you know, Bo, as Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people, is we don't really trust systems that link up and share information about us for very obvious reasons. So what's very different about the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander early education and childcare centres is that they flip that on its head and they place the child first and the families first and offer them the support they need when they need it.
Prior to sort of implementing this as well, were you sort of monitoring children at a young age and seeing where their learning development was?
So the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community childcare centres, they emerged with need, really. A lot of them, what we're seeing now is it hasn't been a sector that's had a lot of funding into it, and it's a sector that's had some real challenges around how it's funded. So it hasn't had the investment, say, that our health services or our legal services have had. Now, don't get me wrong, our health services and legal services have their own funding challenges. But what it's meant is that other agencies were developed. And the primary funding model for our early childcare centres is a subsidy scheme. And again, the subsidy scheme is not fit for purpose, not for our mob. It's geared towards the market. It's geared towards assisting middle-class families ensure that they have two members of their family in the workforce. It isn't geared towards families like those of ours that are vulnerable, that need a little bit of extra support. And that is where the real gains are met in these early childcare centres, is that they offer those families that need that extra support the support they need before there's any trouble. And there's real reasons that we need those things. So it's not only about ensuring our kids hit all their developmental gains, it's also recognising that children that and families that don't get these primary interventions, then get tertiary interventions, and that's not a good thing. That's when you're in. That's when you hit the child protection system. And while there is always a need for ensuring the safety of our children, what we know is that our kids are 11 times more likely to be living in out-of-home care. Very unlikely to be rehomed with their families, and make up 41% of the children in the child protection system. So that number is massive when you consider 41% of our kids in out-of-home care, and yet our children are only 5.9% of the population.
I just really quickly, if you are tuning in to Let's Talk, my guest on the program, Kathleen Little, CEO of Snake, and we're having a chat about National Child Protection Week, which is from the 5th to the 11th of September. And this first part of the program, we've sort of been yarning about the learning stages of kids, especially at a very, very young age. And you brought up some very important points just then as well in regards to the high number of First Nations kids in out-of-home care. Can we talk a bit about that as well in regards to you mentioned, kids in care make up 40%, mm-hmm. and we're, I think you said mm-hmm. around 5%. They're around 5% of the population mm-hmm. Of children in this country. The other week, there was a documentary that came out in regards to the over-incarceration of our incarceration nation, and it sort of highlighted, young children mm-hmm. experiencing the out of home care system and how it's sort of like a pipeline to sort of further incarceration as well.
Yep.
In terms of that. What does sort of Snake have, or what are they implementing or doing in regards to young kids in out-of-home care being put back in home as well? Because, mm-hmm. it's when you mention those numbers, it's very scary.
Oh, it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. Those numbers, what's even more scary about that, Bo, is unless there is transformation in the system, and that is we fundamentally change the way the system works, those numbers will double by 2030.
And if I could just sort of interrupt, sorry, and not to mention that a 10-year-old kid anywhere in this country, I think, can be imprisoned in a youth detention centre. And at sort of any age of a child, they can be removed from their family from birth to sort of anywhere under sort of 16 to 18. They can be put into these systems.
It's before birth. So there is actually a thing called pre-birth notification. And to get, and this is what's really distressing about the child protection system. And one of the things that came up consistently in the consultations we did as part of helping to negotiate the new successor plan, everyone referred to the fact that a number of the families and a number of the mothers that were subject to pre-birth notifications, the reason they were in the system in the first place was because they were removed as children. And so it becomes intergeneration. So they might not have done anything in their own lived experiences as an adult to actually come into contact with the system, but they were flagged because they themselves had been subject to it as children. So, it absolutely happens that children are removed at birth because they were notified, authorities were notified of a risk before the children were born. So these things are startling and terrifying you. And going back to what you originally mentioned, yes, it is true that a significant number of the children in juvenile detention have had contact with the child protection system. Now, this is really, really complicated. It shows a number of things. If you go right back to the beginning, these children didn't have access to the early education and care supports that they needed or their families needed. There were critical intervention points that could have been hit way before this happened. What we know is once you get flagged by the system, you almost never come out of it. And what's wrong with the way the whole system's structured now is that you actually have to be in significant trouble before the interventions or supports are available to you. And I think that's what's really, really fundamental in what we're talking about when I use the word intervention, because it becomes an intervention as opposed to someone removing a barrier for you. It becomes a very, very complicated journey as well. Again, as part of those consultations that we've been having nationally, one of the pieces of evidence we came across was that there was one family that had 40 different caseworkers and 40 different case management plans, and this family was considered to be completely disengaged. How does any family respond to that many different people coming into their homes and telling them how to live? And here's what we need from you. 40 different agencies, 40 different plans. Like, this is just horrific. It does set you up on that trajectory. But there's another couple of things that are really critical about understanding what's happening to those children once they hit the juvenile detention centre. I know in the Territory, for example, what they find is the majority of those children in juvenile detention also have some form of a learning disability that wasn't picked up in their early learning years. And again, this gets us back to why early education and care is so critical. That could have been picked up and dealt with. Those things not picked up and dealt with, not picked up and scaffolded, not picked up and strengthened, do often end up in behaviours that get you notified, that get you noticed, and will end you up in juvenile detention. And again, what we know about life outcomes, children who end up in juvenile detention also are likely to end up in the adult detention system as well. So this is a really, really effective pipeline, right? Once you're in it, you cannot get out of it. It is terrifying, it is alarming, and there is a way to transform it. And that way is to invest early enough. It is to invest in those services that absolute experts on the ground. You know what? Our services, much like we know that our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community-controlled media services are expert in understanding what it is our mob need to hear and using the language we want to hear it in, and trustworthy. You know, we trust our own mob.
Mm. Earlier on in the program, you mentioned the stark numbers of how many kids are in care. I'd love to sort of talk a bit more about that section as well, in regards to the amount of number of kids in care. Are they housed? You know, are they put in accommodation that is within their community, their family network, or amongst Aboriginal people, or the most part, are they put with non-Indigenous sort of families or in care?
Yeah, so the majority of Aboriginal children in out-of-home care, there are 20,000 of our kids in out-of-home care in Australia. The majority of them are not housed with Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander carers or family members. Now, there is a thing called the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle, and it technically has the support of every single jurisdiction. So all states and territories technically support this. And the Child Placement Principle talks about prevention first and then participation, right? So if prevention hasn't worked, if we haven't got in there early enough, how do we ensure that families lead on being able to communicate what their children might need? And again, this is coming to it from an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander perspective of family. So not just mum and dad, but who else is in the family that can talk and support these kids? And what do they need in order to be able to become a kinship carer? And then you've got placement. So talk to the families, talk to the community, understand where else in your community could this child potentially go? And if the community is not the right place, then what other family members are there around the place that can ensure you're connected and remain strong in who you are and understanding who you are and who your mob are? And then you've got participation, right? So you've actually got to be able to still connect to your family somehow. You know, you've still got to be able to understand who you are and where you came from and why it's so incredible to have this to be born into the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. You know, we are incredibly lucky as a people to have this awesome culture beneath us. And then that, of course, means connection, and that is that you're connected to your mob, you're connected to your country, you're connected to your people. And those kids that are better connected, they're the ones getting the best life outcomes. What we find with all of these things is it's often misinterpreted as like a hierarchy, so it becomes a checklist. And the moment it becomes a hierarchy, you actually undermine the fact that the child placement principle is based on transformation, and that is you have to fundamentally change the way our children are and our families are dealt with, change the infrastructure that supports our children and families, and actually look at what outcomes could be like. You know, don't go back to the corner and default to an easy placement. Change the way our social workers are exposed to Aboriginal cultures or Torres Strait Islander cultures. Understand what poverty looks like instead of neglect. You know, really critical things like these that can that are underlying drivers that lead our children and our families into the child protection system. And for those drivers to be effectively tackled, we are genuinely talking about systemic reform. It isn't just one piece of the puzzle. It's looking at things like what's housing like in your community, what's the electricity supply like in your community, what sort of services to early education and care do you have, what sort of jobs do your parents have access to, and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on.
Very interesting thing that you just mentioned before, the difference between poverty and neglect. And social workers sort of understanding that as well. I remember up here, Aunty Karen Fusi, who was a part of the Grandmothers Against Removal, done an amazing work within that space to fight for not just her own our grannies to be returned to her and family members, but many others up here in Southeast Queensland. And I remember yarning with her one time, and she was saying, oh, you know, after she got her babies back, you know, all these mob were like, oh, it's a deadly aunt, you know, and could you help us? You know, could you help us build a case? And she goes, yeah, by all means, I'll build a case. And, you know, she would talk to a few families and I'd all say the exact same thing that, you know, when these workers would come around, you know, there would be either no food or not much food. And I'd automatically think neglect and not sort of look at what you just mentioned, poverty. And through her and, you know, through the community here in Brisbane, you know, they raised, you know, money for food for some of these families. So next time these workers came in, the shelves were filled, but it also gave them time to build a case in terms of, you know, going to the department up here and building a case and fighting to get their kids back as well. And just on what you were saying before in terms of this generational sort of where the mothers or the fathers are flagged because, you know, they were taken. And so, you know, when they have children, you know, there's a red flag for removal. I remember Aunty Karen actually telling another story, and my partner was there. And they called Aunty Karen and said, oh, you know, aunt, come quick, they're going to take my baby. And by the time they got to the hospital, they weren't allowed out of the elevator because there was a row of police officers standing in front of the door, you know, ready to sort of, you know, stop, you know, these aunties and these other women coming in to sort of support this young mum. And I remembered chatting with Peter Reid, who wrote the book. Let me just get it up. It is the book he wrote, The Removal of Aboriginal Children in New South Wales in from 1883 to 1969 on the Stolen Generation. And I remember him talking about how, I think it was like around 1970 or 1971, where they sort of changed the law in terms of the removal of children. Because before that, you know, they just used to remove Aboriginal children in big groups, big numbers, and then they sort of changed it to sort of individuals and stuff as well. And when you were talking about sort of that whole generational thing, you know, we have, you know, three, four generations today of people who have been a part of sort of this stolen generation system that, you know, I'm sure we get triggered, you know, when they see these workers coming in and coming through their homes with police officers as well, which in itself is very, very traumatising.
Yep, and certainly those, if I point to those consultations that we have had over the course of the year, that came up regularly, was that, you know, well, we've heard cases. I think we're hitting now six generations of removal. So you, once you're in that cycle, it is incredibly hard to break out of it because you weren't given the tools you needed and you are suffering from trauma, and we haven't been good as a nation in being able to assist our families in the healing after removal. You know, this was awful. You know, the removal started with an assimilation policy, right? That was taking our babies off us because we couldn't look after them. And yet when you think about it, our own cultural care systems were incredibly sophisticated and remain incredibly sophisticated. So I should reinforce here, of course, that the majority of our kids, you know, they grew up safe and strong and well and connected to culture. That is the vast majority of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. But for those mob that have hit this disruptive cycle, it is an absolutely horrific journey. And our own systems, they had things in place. It didn't matter if you didn't have food, because you know what? Your family had food and you were welcome to that food. It didn't matter if one of your parents or mum was having a hard time, because you know what? You had more than one mum and those people could be there for you. It didn't matter if someone was busy, because you know what? You got nanas and you got grandpas, and there were distinct roles in how we taught you about culture, how we taught you about law, how we taught you to hunt, how we taught you how to gather, how we taught you how to light fires. This was an incredibly sophisticated system and remains an incredibly sophisticated system where you belong to your family and your community. It is the child protection system that is disruptive.
Let's talk. I'd love to have a chat now about adoption, you know, and in regards to the stolen generation, you know, the early sort of first part of the stolen generation that we know, you know, the forced adoptions. Yeah. Today, in regards to adopting Aboriginal children, can anybody do that, or is it just specifically Aboriginal sort of families and communities that have a say in terms of who adopts Aboriginal children? And is there still this sort of, I don't know, contentious sort of look at the adoption of Aboriginal children?
It's still a bit of a minefield, Bo. It is weighted towards Aboriginal family members being able to adopt, and it is still technically weighted to Aboriginal communities being able to do this. But yes, anyone can adopt an Aboriginal child, but it's harder to do. But like I said, it's like anything with the child placement principle. It's how it's implemented. It's who's I guess making the decisions on what effective implementation looks like, and there is no there's no uniform tool across the nation that says, okay, well, what were your outcomes and what did they look like and what went right and what went wrong and how do we ensure this works better? And I think what's really interesting, and I think I missed it a bit earlier when you were talking about it, what we do know is where we have Aboriginal community controlled organisations moving into guardianship, so that is into the protective space, the outcomes for rehoming are significantly different. So, for example, Victoria has only very recently taken on child guardianship through VACCA, and almost immediately the results start coming in, and they're showing that a significant number of children are now being rehomed into their own family, so you don't need to look at out-of-home care or adoption. And there are less critical interventions required for these families because they're working with people who understand trauma, understand lived experience and understand what they're actually looking at and what people are trying to communicate when they're distressed and feeling fearful. And less instances of court referrals for any of the family members. So it's really quite remarkable what these Aboriginal community controlled services are managing. And certainly in Queensland, you've got Queensland 33 Child and Family Wellbeing Services, and they've managed to halve the number of re-notifications to child protection once they actually started the transition of services. So it is quite remarkable what happens when you actually invest in the people mm-hmm. who have the relationships mm-hmm. with community, know their families and have the skills and the expertise to actually understand what's going on here.
I know from previously chatting with the CEO of AICS up here in Brisbane in regards mm-hmm. to some of the amazing work that they're doing down there to support families wholeheartedly, you know, sort of around you know, not just sort of in the health space, but, you know, in other fields as well. And, you know, is that, you know, you just sort of mentioned in regards to that as well. Do we need to be sort of servicing not just sort of individual families, but sort of communities to have various other programs in place to support whatever need, you know, the family may need when their children are in care, then, you know, when they're back as well, back home?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That one is a no-brainer. But again, the majority of dollars attributed to child protection go into tertiary intervention. So it's only 16% of the funding that goes into this space actually looks at how do we help you before there's trouble. Imagine what it would look like if you changed that funding formula, if you got really, really brave and really, really bold about how this is going to work. That's one way of doing it. But again, when I talk about the Aboriginal community controlled sector, that's what they're experts at again too. Hey, understanding what is it that your mob need on the ground. You know, none of our services are singular. You know, they are all multifunctional because they understand, much like Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people understand, it's not one thing, it's a sum of all things. I've got this uncle, and this is a true story, when he talks about what he sees as a truly innovative and transformational way to change this, he says, what would happen if you ensured that every one of those families had a safe house to live in and food, and it was furnished and it had a fridge, and that there was the ability to pay the bills on time? What would happen? Don't know. I often think about that, and I think, I wonder how the world would change if everyone had an equal footing.
Definitely. And not just sort of an equal footing, but the people sort of in these sort of key positions who do remove kids had more of an understanding in terms of the history, you know, the politics, the socioeconomic sort of issues that sort of come on in communities as well. Like, would, you know, everything would definitely be very, very different. Catherine, we've come to the end of our yarn. I do want to thank you for coming on this morning and having this very, very important conversation. If anybody out there is listening and wants to know more about some of the amazing work your mob are doing on a national scale, where can they go?
There is the SNAKE website is the best way to find SNAKE. And again, SNAKE is a peak body, so we don't do the work on the ground. Our members and our communities do those things, but we do the work behind the scenes that puts the policy levers in place so that our communities and our organisations actually have what they need to be able to deliver the best services.
Thank you for coming on this morning as well, and would definitely love to have you back on here on Let's Talk in the future.
Thank you.
If I just tuning in on Let's Talk, my guest, Catherine Little, CEO of SNAKE, and we've been having a chat about National Child Protection Week, which is from the 5th to the 11th of September. Going to head to a quick break and we'll be back. After that, you are listening to Let's Talk here on Murray Country, 98.9 FM.
We have worked together to protect our family and the community from the spread of COVID-19. Now it's time that we step up and get vaccinated. Stepping up for the jab means much more than just protecting yourself. It's also about making sure our mob, particularly our elders, are safe and protected from COVID-19. It also means we can get back to catching up with family at gatherings, in our homes and community. Step up for your mob and book an appointment today. Our clinics are taking appointments for mob aged 12 and over. To book your vaccine or for more information about the facts on the vax, visit www.istepedup.com.au.
A message from the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health. Station sponsor.
This is Bo Spirum. Let's Talk.
night in a native camp I'll never forget. A young black mother, her cheeks all wet. Yahweh, Yahweh, my brown skin baby, they take him away. Between her sobs I heard her say, baby away from white men, boss, that baby I have, why he let him take baby away. Yahweh, Yahweh, my brown skin baby, they take him away. Children's home, our baby came with new clothes on and a new name. Day and night he would always say, Mummy, Mummy, why they take me away? He loved so to find his mother. He tried in vain. Upon this earth, they never met again.
Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Hey, if you're just tuning in to the program, my first guest on Let's Talk, Catherine Little, CEO of Snake. We were having a chat about National Child Protection Week from the 5th to the 11th of September. At this part of the program, we want to highlight something very, very important. As this year marks the 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, also today is the birthday of Aunty Tanya Day. And for people who don't know, Aunty Tanya Day is a Yorta Yorta woman who sadly lost her life in police custody in December 2017. And today, this is obviously is a special day for the family members and other people who have lost loved ones and understand, you know, the pain and the hurt that family members go through as well. I want to bring in April. Good morning, sis. How you going?
Morning, Bryce. How are you?
Good. I think it's finally the first time I've got you on the studio. I've been saying for ages. Nah.
Yeah, right. Only down the hallway.
Yeah. Nah, thanks for coming on, sis. Today is an important day for yourself and your family.
Yeah, she would have been 59 today, so last year of her 50s bliss.
True. Same age as my mum. She's 59. She's 60 next year, yeah.
Yeah.
And last year, I believe it was, your daughter come up with...
It was actually my niece.
Your niece, sorry, yes.
Yeah, so my brother Warren, his daughter, she was 8 when she had come up with this idea. And it was real sweet because she just took that initiative herself, and knowing that pink was her nan's favourite colour, she just like sat there for ages. She was sitting there for hours doing that flyer up by herself on the iPad. Yeah, and then she sent it to me and gave me the directions of what to do and told me, can you post this? Can you crop that? So, yeah, it was really beautiful that she come up with that idea on her own.
And the support around, you know, people wearing pink on today, last year, how was it?
It was huge. We didn't expect it to be as big as it was. It was just lovely to see how much of our Aboriginal community got behind us, but as well as our allies and supporters. And there was a lot of public figures that had got behind it. Paul Kelly had shared a photo. So there was a lot of big artists and actors that had supported it. And there was also a fair bit of media around it as well.
Mm. And obviously this is just, you know, one, to sort of carry that legacy and honour, you know, a mother, a grandmother, an auntie, a community member. But for people sort of outside of that, it's a way to sort of get in and know somebody. You know, like we were chatting last week just about this as well, and, you know, talking about, you know, the importance of sort of humanising people who have gone through this, and, you know, like so many other families that have gone through this, they've had to sort of witness how, you know, conservative mainstream media sort of, you know, point the finger or sort of paint our mob. You know, I think this is amazing in terms of, you know, just everybody loves the colour.
Mm.
You know, that many people who love pink as well, and, you know, the instant sort of connection I think that people would sort of have with that as well, and, you know, whether it's a small gesture of wearing a colour, but, you know, knowing that people are sort of saying, you know, using, you know, certain hashtags and raising awareness as well, that's sort of a big part about it as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we were really mindful of that even after we lost Mum and while we were going through the coronial inquest, and that, you know, she is more than just another number and statistic added to, you know, an Aboriginal death in custody. So everything we did was having Mum, who she was and her legacy, in the forefront of our mind, and also who she was to our kids. You know, she was a grandmother of eight. Two of those grandkids she didn't get to meet because of her losing her life to systemic racism. So being able to see that still carry on years after her death is goes to show, you know, when you set those things in motion at the start, how much it can help keep that legacy alive. And like we said, you know, humanising our loved ones and making sure that there's no chance that the media can pick out anything negative, because we've just filled it with so much love, strength and light.
Have you been getting notifications today?
This is the thing, like when it's Mum's birthday, now that we've done this, like I feel like the whole day I'm just sitting on my phone, you know, like resharing. Yeah. And last year it got to the point that like Instagram wasn't letting me share anymore, because there were so many tags and so many photos that it was just like reached the max of like, you know, what we could share.
Almost shut down Instagram.
Yeah, my Instagram started glitching.
Yeah. No, it's awesome, sis. And for anybody out there listening, you know, if they are wearing pink today and they do sort of want to jump on and support, or if they just want to find more information about Aunty Tanya, or even just about the amazing work you're doing with the Dajwa Foundation, where can people go?
Yeah, so we've got a few different pages. So you can go to Justice for Tanya Day page on Instagram and Facebook for the updates about Mum, and just make sure that if you do wear something pink that you post a photo and use the hashtag Pink for Tanya and tag us. And then for Dajwa Foundation, there's Dajwa Foundation Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, as well as a website, dajwa.com.au. So on that is a bit more broader information around Aboriginal deaths in custody and the families that we support. And you can also find the latest tile, which shares our donation details.
I'd love to get you back on to have a chat more about Dajwa Foundation, which was launched last year?
It was officially launched in April, but yeah, had been doing the work for a little bit.
One thing I find interesting is not all media, but there's a majority of media, when they report about your mother, they use, you know, Aunty in front as well.
Mm.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, we had spoken to a lot of media and told them to do that. You know, it's just that ensuring that they give that Mum that respect. And, you know, she loved being called Aunty, and she would make sure that she would pull the young ones up and, you know, I just think that that's really important that they respect those wishes. And then obviously you see the ones that, you know, don't listen to that.
Yeah, because I thought that was interesting as well because, yeah, you know, as you mentioned, not all media, but, you know, I guess the ones that, you know, are trying to sort of do better do use that as well. Sis, you know, thank you for coming on and having a yarn with us here on Let's Talk as well. Yeah, definitely jump on to your socials on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter to have a look at Justice for Tenure Day or the Dajua Foundation. And if you are wearing pink, definitely hashtag and tag those pages as well. And yeah, as I mentioned, sis, would love to get you back on to have a chat about the Dajua Foundation as well, because he's had, as you mentioned, launched in April down home in Vic, had an amazing support from various different artists, and I think the work that you are doing to support families is amazing as well, so we'd definitely love to sort of look at that more and understand more about the Dajua Foundation.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed the program this morning, just remember you can head to 989fm.com.au for the links to the podcast, and you can listen to today's and also previous Let's Talk programs. As always, it's a pleasure. You've been listening to Let's Talk here on 989FM, Murray Country.